Welcome to Auk Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. In today's episode, we spoke with Ronan J. Kelly, MD, MBA, FASCO, and Michelle Schiller, DO, APCP, and GP, about HER2 immunohistochemistry testing in non-small cell lung cancer. In our conversation, Drs. Kelly and Schiller discussed the importance of performing IHC testing for HER2 in non-small cell lung cancer, how IHC results may influence treatment decision-making beyond the scope of next-generation sequencing, and recommendations for efficient and collaborative IHC testing implementation in clinical practice.
Hi, my name is Dr. Ronan Kelly. I'm the Director of Oncology at the Charles A. Sammons Cancer Center in Dallas, Texas, and it's a real pleasure to be here, and I'd like to introduce my colleague, Dr. Michelle Schiller.
Hi, my name is Michelle Schiller. I'm a molecular pathologist, and I have the privilege of working with Dr. Kelly and many other great oncologists at Baylor Scott & White Health. So we're here today to talk to you about some important biomarkers.
Thank you so much, Drs. Kelly and Schiller, for taking the time to speak with us today on an episode of Onc Live On Air. Just to start off, how prevalent are HER2 mutations in non-small cell lung cancer?
Well, I think when we're talking about targeting HER2 in lung cancer, we have to take a step back because there's really, you know, three different areas, right? So we've got the HER2 mutations, we've then got the amplifications and the overexpression. So when you talk about HER2 mutations, we're really talking about maybe 2 to 4% of lung cancer would fall into that category, which would be considered HER2 mutations. And those are usually picked up by NGS panels, and we'd hear from Dr. Schiller about, you know, the role of NGS in detecting HER2 mutations. Then, of course, we've got the amplifications or the overexpression, which aren't traditionally picked up by NGS panels, and that's where the immunohistochemistry is really important. So the oncologists around the United States just have to really get familiar with not just relying on NGS anymore. I think IHC, certainly for HER2, is an important addition to our landscape, and we need to be able to evaluate whether HER2 amplification or overexpression is present. Now, about 3 to 5% of solid tumors would be HER2 amplified. Lung cancer would be similar to that. About 2 to 3% would be HER2 amplified. In terms of overexpression, you could say about 13 to 20% of lung cancers have overexpression, but if you break that down into just the +3 category, those that are really where the FDA approval is, that again would fall into that 2 to 5% category. So I think across the board, when you look at HER2 mutations, you're looking at 2 to 4%, and then overexpression or amplification, similar prevalence around that 2, 3, 4% range.
What are some of the limitations of NGS testing for non-small cell?
Well, so I love the overview Dr. Kelly provided about ERBB2 and interrogating it in all types of tumor, but focusing on lung cancer here. So the biggest limitation, if we're looking at the use of some of the therapies, is that it doesn't measure the expression, right? It is simply just detecting alterations in genetic pathways. So it's important to understand is we have an increasing robustness of antibody-drug conjugate pipelines that function differently than tyrosine kinase inhibitors, et cetera. What the test is testing for and what that means in terms of when you're thinking about therapy. So next-generation sequencing will not, detect protein expression because it's a genome-based assay. And then another thing that it is limited in, and I just want to put that out here at this time, is sometimes you will see NGS say ERBB2 amplified, but that isn't a strong point of next generation sequencing copy number change. It will see a change in the copy number, but it can't give you a quantified, we are definitely meeting that threshold that we've understood for the cytogenetic definition of the use of amplification. So where it's relevant, it's good to be able to reflex that and work with laboratories that have the ability to use orthogonal methods to then say, okay, you know what? NGS detected amplification. Let's actually do that by FISH and see if that gene truly is amplified from a cytogenetics perspective. So as Dr. Kelly iterated, utilizing one assay for everything they all have their strengths and weaknesses. And so unfortunately, not even NGS is going to answer all of the questions that we need to answer.
That being said, what is the importance of performing IHC testing for HER2 in non-small cell lung cancer? And how might these results influence treatment decision-making beyond what NGS can offer?
Yeah, so here again, it's all about understanding the pathways, understanding what you're testing. So you can have a mutation, and that's not necessarily going to significantly impact the expression based on a cutoff that we use for FDA labels for patient responses. So you can have HER2 overexpression that meets the threshold for FDA approval that may be present, and the tumor may be otherwise negative if you've done NGS for a mutation in ERBB2. So it's important really to run both of them. And really for best tissue stewardship, it's best to have a plan for that going into it. For example, for our lung cancer cases, they all get broad genomic profiling, NGS, and we also run PD-L1 and HER2 IHC on all of them. That way we can optimize the tissue and make sure we don't run out. The other thing is based on the FDA label, we're utilizing the gastric interpretive criteria, which varies based on whether or not you're dealing with a biopsy specimen or a surgical resected specimen. So with the IHC, those interpretive criteria are going to vary based on exactly what type of specimen it is you're dealing with.
At what points in the diagnostic and treatment plan should HER2 IHC testing be performed in these patients?
Yeah, no, I think we really need to be doing this straight away. You know, what we've implemented here at Baylor University Medical Center is that all lung cancers, regardless of stage, we are reflexly checking all known, you know, oncogenic drivers. We have a large panel of over 500 genes, but, you know, we really make sure that everything that is FDA approved is being evaluated up front. And so the medical oncologist has that information straight away. So my colleagues in molecular pathology, Dr. Schiller and colleagues, really understand. We had this discussion many years ago when we saw a lot of even the adjuvant studies where we saw a lot of new oncogenic driver mutation FDA approvals there. So let's not be waiting for stage. Let's just do this on all lung cancers here in Dallas. And that's what we've been implementing so that we have the information straight away when we see the patient. Dr. Schiller, any other thoughts on that?
No, I think I really like how you're highlighting how we've really worked together. It is a conversation to have with your clinical colleagues, but, you know, these biomarkers, nothing happens with the patient until this information is known. So it is as timely as the actual diagnosis itself, and it needs to move in a very progressive, stepwise fashion without delay.
You know, the reason this is important specifically at HER2 now is we're seeing a lot of changes, right? So we've had, since the DESTINY-Lung02 trial, where trastuzumab deruxtecan, also known as Enhertu, was approved. And that approval came in August of 2022. So we had that second line approval for trastuzumab deruxtecan in those patients. Then, of course, last year in 2024, we got the FDA tumor agnostic approval for HER2 with the use of that particular antibody drug conjugate. And then just last week, just recently in August of 2025, we had zongertinib approved, which is, we'll talk about, but that was based on the Beamium Lung-1 study, which is a small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And that also has very exciting information. But again, that's approved in the HER2 mutation population. So we have the drugs now, and we just need to make sure everyone is getting that target assessed in as timely a manner as possible, because we don't want to miss those. So as I said, FDA approvals are coming now. We've more and more drugs on the horizon. So we need to make sure we work with our pathology colleagues to get these checked in a timely manner.
Is HER2 IHC testing a standard part of your practice when treating patients with non-small cell lung cancer?
Oh, for sure. But, you know, the what I see around the U.S. sometimes is that people are still just doing NGS in lung. They now need to move and start doing IHC analysis in lung as well. That's a bit of a change that we haven't had to do in the last number of years. Other tumor types have had to do that, of course, where they've been relying on IHC. And In lung, we've really just been doing that for PD-L1, but now we need this for HER2, and there'll be other targets emerging very quickly in the next couple of years.
What advice do you have for colleagues at institutions with labs that don't automatically conduct HER2 IHC testing?
I would encourage them to have a multidisciplinary dialogue with their clinical colleagues and really look at the approvals, look at the NCCN guidelines, make sure that what they're doing is at a minimum aligning with the guidelines. And these biomarkers are listed in the guidelines. And, you know, there are all types of different practice settings out there. So in some of them, pathology is a little bit further removed from the treating groups. So it does seem like tumor conferences is one place that a lot of institutions come together, but really just being proactive and making sure that the testing that they are performing is meeting the needs of their clinical providers, and also being the advocates as the laboratory physicians, knowing exactly what the biomarkers are that are relevant. In this case, it's lung cancer, and ensuring that all of those things are considered. Again, tissue stewardship is very important here. A lot of times we're dealing with small biopsies. And so it's ideal to try to know what you're going to need on the front end, cut all that tissue on the front end. That way you can optimize and get as much as you can from that tissue.
Are there any other practical barriers that may arise for colleagues as they try to implement more IHC testing in their practice?
The tissue stewardship is going to be that biggest barrier because when we have a biopsy, we are limited in the tissue. So a couple of things that we've done. First of all, we label all biopsies, particularly lung biopsies, as special handling so that the technicians that cut those cases are very careful with the tissue and, you know to really be mindful with every cut that we take. We also cut unstained slides on the front end. But the caveat with that is that those unstained slides need to move to testing within 14 days or else you've lost that because you start getting degradation fairly quickly. And then again, having a plan. And I can't emphasize having a plan enough on the front end. For example, there's other biomarkers that have been approved in lung cancer now that are using IHC, and some of them depend on the presence or absence of a mutation in a different genes, for example, and there's others in the pipeline. So really understanding what the role is of the biomarker and when it comes into hand, and communicating with our clinical colleagues, knowing, oh, is this a treatment naive tumor? Is this a patient's first progression? What was their initial line of therapy? So that we can make sure that we're triaging the testing fully relevant and appropriate to that patient's case.
What are some of the NCCN guidelines surrounding the optimal use of HER2 IHC testing for non-small cell lung cancer?
Well, you know, given these trials, we're seeing Category 1 evidence, and this is a new target that should be part of standard day-to-day testing. You know, if we look back again, we've had the DESTINY-Lung trial, the 02 trial showed a response rate of 58%. And then the most recent small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitor studies showing response rates in the 70-71%. The other thing which is exciting is these drugs seem to be working, either small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitors or antibody drug conjugates, in CNS sanctuary sites. So we are seeing patients now who previously, as a result of, you know, drugs that maybe didn't cross the blood-brain barrier, not really responding in the CNS. These HER2-targeted drugs, either trastuzumab deruxtecan or zongertinib, are penetrating the blood-brain barrier. We're seeing efficacy there, and that's exciting for our patients. So this should be part of day-to-day practice now, in addition to all of the other targets like EGFR and ALK and so on and so forth. HER2 has firmly entered this space as a target. And so we need to make sure this is part of a routine day-to-day assessments.
How can medical oncologists and pathologists work together to ensure HER2 testing is happening for all patients for whom it is recommended?
As the director of this, you know, top 50 cancer center here at Baylor University Medical Center, we're privileged to work with such a great molecular pathology group. And I know not every cancer center throughout the country has molecular pathologists on their campus, but you know what we've done is we work as a team. We started off many years ago identifying lung cancer obviously is the poster child for targeted therapies, but we do this in all solid tumors. But in lung, we, for example, work with Dr. Schiller to make sure that every patient, regardless of stage, is getting NGS performed and now IHC performed on all their specimens. That, of course, would require buy-in from the interventional radiologist to make sure they get the tissue. We need to get the results back in a timely manner. So having that workflow worked through so that we're not waiting for results and we have them when our patients come to see us. And then just really having that as part of our day-to-day practice. You know, we need to make sure that every patient has access to the best available treatment. And that's really what precision medicine is all about. And working with your molecular pathology colleagues on a day-to-day basis, having great communication, overcoming challenges, overcoming any barriers, that's the key. And we've been able to do that here. And we're really proud of the process that we put in place. But Dr. Schiller and her colleagues have been integral to that. Michelle, I don't know if you have any other thoughts on how you work with oncologists.
Yeah, you know, I really couldn't say it any better than Dr. Kelly said. We're really open books. The communication's bidirectional. And, you know, we can't be better if we don't know where they're having troubles or things that are missing. And they can't be better without us saying, hey, let's think about it this way. So it's really, it starts with that open dialogue, including, you know, the interventionalist, including every single person matters and counts. But the pre-analytics, so once our people who, the interventionalists receive the tissue and acquire it, we need to make sure it gets fixed properly and it's, you know, gets to the lab in a timely fashion. All of these things impacting the downstream ability to actually perform the test. So it really is that cohesive team effort and realizing how important every person's interaction is for the ultimate outcome of the patient.
Just starting to wrap up, what would be your main message about HER2 IHC testing for colleagues in either academic or community settings who may be skeptical about adopting HER2 IHC testing in their practice?
The era of the antibody drug conjugates is here, right? So we've all been used to the small molecule TKIs and we've been able to target those or use those based on NGS. But the ADCs will require us to get used to getting more tissue and then running IHC on those. So we're just talking about one target, HER2 amplification or expression. It's very important. We've had to do this in other solid tumors. The lung cancer community will just have to get used to the fact that some of the ADCs now will require IHC testing. So I would encourage everyone just to start building this into your day-to-day workflows now, because we can see what's coming down the pipeline with more and more ADCs coming that'll target novel pathways. So I would encourage working with your interventional radiologist to get more tissue if required, and then working with molecular pathology to ensure that stewardship is as seamless as possible so we get those results in a timely manner. But I just think this is where it's all going. We've had to do IHC in many other solid tumors for many years. So lung cancer has just really entered that space now in a big way. And I think it's very exciting for our patients.
Yeah, and I agree. I also would just say, you know, emphasize the need to be flexible. So for example, I'll just kind of create a scenario that we worked through or how we worked through it. So for other laboratorians listening out there, with the NTRK fusion approval in lung, well, across tumor types impacting lung cancer years ago, we would run a TRK IHC to screen just given limitations of assay performance, et cetera. Well, so we were already running two IHCs, right? We were running PD-L1 and TRK. Well, the positive rate on a TRK IHC is quite low and even lower for a mutation in lung cancer. So we decided to lean in on our assay more to try to detect it and utilize that IHC that we were otherwise delegating for TRK for HER2 once that FDA approval landed. And then we have other ways to make sure we don't miss a TRK mutation in addition to the IHC, but we just shifted the testing approach. So a little bit of flexibility goes a long way. And again, really understanding the patient, where they're at in their course of therapy and disease course, as well as the role of particular biomarkers in which phase of therapy that they're in, and as well as whether or not they're inducible, lots of moving parts, but just really understanding it at the granular level to make sure that you can add that flexibility in and say, oh, well, you know, maybe we don't need to test it on the de novo because we don't even expect to see it. But if the patient progresses, then we'll perform it at that time. And maybe we won't perform some other biomarker that may not be relevant.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.